Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 92. On this episode, we are talking about the film Room. Room was a 2015 film that kind of continues our recent postings and reviews about films that were nominated for Academy Awards, some of the best of 2015. To help me talk about Room, I brought on Josh Crabb and Laura Fissel, two great guests from Real World Theology. This film, the reason we're talking about it is, I mean, it won an Oscar. Now that at the time we recorded this, the Oscars are already over. Brie Larson, Best Actress in hand. Another couple of nominations, but we really felt that it was a small film with big themes. It confronts some tough ideas, and it does it with care and precision. And so in this conversation, we get to explore the idea of a world bigger than the one we can perceive, and it's really, really great. So I encourage you to stick around for that, and in general, make sure you guys are checking out realworldtheology.com for all the things we post there, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts. Check out our Facebook page, our Twitter, at Real World Theology and Real World Theo, respectively. Subscribe to the podcast, guys, iTunes, Stitcher, Feedburner, however you get it, and look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. Also, please rate and review the show however you're checking it out. It helps people find our show, and the more people involved in the conversation, typically the better conversations we're having. So, this is a really great show, and I'm pretty excited for you to listen to it. Here it is, episode 92, Room and a World Beyond Imagination.
I can't wait to get to the part of the podcast where we talk about, like, our favorite moments.
Yeah, the ones that just made us like roll in the aisles.
Yeah.
When we're like, oh, ha, I was R-O-F-T-L-L-ing, O-L-L-ing.
Yeah, there are literally almost, I can't think of any moments in this movie where I was genuinely like, oh, this is nice.
Yeah.
It's like,
this makes me feel good.
I'm either angry or crying. Yeah. I think that should have been the tagline. It's like, go see Room. You will either be angry or crying.
I will say, I think I have a favorite moment, but it comes from not from the movie.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense, seeing as how it's supposed to be. You're not even paying attention to the rules. We're gonna put you back
my
in the room,
favorite
Josh.
Moment is when I woke up and had breakfast.
My name's Mikey and I like to party. Wait a minute. My name's Laura and I like to party. Oh gosh. So the thing about this film, which is adapted from a novel by the actual person who wrote the novel, which is actually kind of cool, is that it wasn't that big of a film. I feel like most people miss this.
Mm-hmm.
Heck, I when it came to theaters, I did not hear enough about it, which is kind of odd, to even make me want to really go see it at first. I mean, it's one of those things I was like, well, Brie Larson's involved, I'm going to go see it. I loved her in Short Term 12. Everyone loved her in Short Term 12. Anyone who's seen Short Term 12 loves Brie Larson. Because the movie is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Work...
Which is why it's crazy that people were like, hey, this is her breakout. I'm like, pretty sure her breakout already happened, guys.
Y'all need to go back, watch the real... You know, as much as I think we all enjoyed Room, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but Short Term 12, if I had to pick between these two movies, would be... I wouldn't even blink. I love Short Term 12.
Mm-hmm.
Way more than I loved Room, and I think that should be more of a compliment to Short Term 12 than it is a detriment to Room. But
right, exactly.
You know, but they found a director in Lenny Abramson, who directed Frank, and I'm not sure if many people saw Frank, but I think Frank is worth a lot of people's time too.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that I want people to really take from this episode of the podcast is that you should go see all these other movies. Because they're yeah. great too. So there's a lot of people who have been involved in really good stuff who worked on this movie. So you bring all that together. It doesn't always work, but I think it does this time. And, you know, your cast isn't, you're not blown away by the cast. Lots of the film is going to, the success of the film at least, or the emotion, the emotional conveyance of the film is going to be based on the acting of, how old is Jacob Tremblay? Like eight?
Eight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know,
something like that. Yeah.
So he's 7 or 8. So your film's, you know, told through the eyes of a 8-year-old who's playing, I guess, a 5-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of ways that this film could go wrong, doesn't, ends up garnering lots of attention. You know, it's one of those word of mouth things. You see the film, you're like, you've got to see this film. They see two of your friends see it. They tell two people and they tell two people.
Did it not have a wide release?
It did not have, I mean, technically it had a wide release, but it was still mostly released in film or in theaters that carry like smaller, more independent films. Mm-hmm. You know, it was never like the film that's in the stadium seating with 2-3 screens devoted to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. I believe when we saw it, we watched it at like the independent theater at Friendly.
Mm-mm.
We did not.
We watched it at home.
We did. Yeah. We finally saw it at home. Okay, so we finally saw it at home.
This is something you're gonna cut out of the podcast.
No. Because we saw a lot of films that were nominated for Oscars, and lots of them at home, and lots of it was along the same lines as the smaller films that we see, like in the independent
mm-hmm.
one theater that one of the larger theaters in town devotes to kind of smaller films,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the other theater that is like all independent films that no one goes to that theater because it's independent films.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't really heavily publicized. Obviously a lot more once the studio started putting money and the Oscar kind of nom started coming. So it's cool to see something that kind of was a swell. It slowly built up. It slowly gained an audience. It slowly gained traction. That was really great to see. And I think well deserved. And I think the reason we're talking about it is because we all are kind of in agreement for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that I guess I would like, now that we framed that a little bit, I think I'd like to start this by asking this question of the two of you, Josh and Laura. Room is a film that, like I say, it isn't funny. It isn't light. The only jokes we can make are about how we can't make any jokes about the film. it's almost unrelenting with its story. So when a film is this heavy and it deals with, you know, subjects that are so tough, you know, like we may have already mentioned, depending on when this episode actually starts, you know, kidnapping, rape, oppression, child endangerment, just trying to deal with these things, like where is the upside of us or anyone else actually engaging with this film?
Well, I think they told the story probably in I'm gonna say the only way they could, but that's just because I haven't thought of all the possibilities, but they told the story in a way that allows us to engage with the subject matter without being basically drown under the weight of it, and that is by choosing an innocent narrator.
Mm-hmm.
So that we get to see, we're really seeing like a muted version of the events that's happening.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're right, and they do tell it in a way that is more palpable, and as some critics have said, they walk that line and never fall over into like exploitation,
mm-hmm.
which would have been easy for them to do. But like, what value can we get from subjecting ourselves to a film with such themes?
Well, I have an answer for that too. But do you want to say something, Josh?
No, I'm still thinking about it, because I kind of feel this. I mean, you kind of already touched on what I was going to jump in and say about it, you know, kind of avoiding the exploitation narrative, which could have easily done
mm-hmm.
and other films have done to its detriment. You know, I mean, I think that the the theme of dealing with a woman who is either like sexually exploited or physically or sexually abused or emotionally abused or something like that has been treated in a very exploitative way in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first thing I think of is whatever that Jennifer Lopez movie was where, you know, she was like physically abused and like she had had enough and gosh, I can't remember the name of it.
I think but, it was called, it's called Enough.
It's Enough? Oh my gosh. But, you know, it's kind of like it's, you know, then she like trains so she can fight back or whatever. And it just that, you know, I mean, besides the fact that, like, you know, Brie Larson's in a completely different category of actress compared to Jennifer Lopez. But I feel like it's been mishandled. The whole theme has been extremely mishandled before. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth exploring because this movie does such a good job of handling it in a way that's non-exploitative. And again, you know, it's being told through a kid's perspective, but is clearly still about a relationship between a child and his mother, which I think is probably one of the most, you know, I don't understand that relationship because I'm not a woman. You know, I have four kids, but there's something about a relationship between children and their mother that a husband or a father cannot understand,
mm-hmm.
And probably never will. You know, as obvious as it is that, you know, whenever a kid gets hurt, they ask for mom, not dad. Even if, you know, I'm actually the only one there with them.
but I don't want you.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that's, but there's something innocent and pure about that relationship that makes this story a lot better than just sort of like the, you know, now the woman's out to just get revenge on the mm-hmm. abusive person. Well, so, and yeah. I don't feel like this has any, this doesn't smack of any sort of revenge or anything like that, which I appreciated.
Yeah, I feel like, I'm not going to say it has no value, but I feel like a narrative like that, like the Enough movie.
Mm-hmm. The Enough movie.
Yeah. Says that that the only redemption to be had is taking justice into your own hands.
Right, you know? Right.
That there's not going to be any kind of healing unless there's, you know, reciprocal violence or whatever. But I feel like, so I feel like my answer to your question, Mikey, is not unlike yours, Josh, but I feel like stories like this, real life stories about abductions, can be really sensational stories to read. You know, mm-hmm. like a train wreck, they kind of pull you in because they're unbelievable. You can't believe this kind mm-hmm. of thing would happen. But, and this kind of struck me from one of the reviews that Mikey linked to us beforehand. One of the reviews mentioned several real life abductions that have happened that this story mm-hmm. is mirroring, but he didn't use the names of the women that were abducted. And I was thinking, that's not weird to me. I mean, he used the names of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
That's not weird to me, but I feel like it should be that we, you know, if we're really interested in these stories, shouldn't we be interested about in the people that it happened to? Shouldn't that be the central focus? And I feel like that's what this film does, which makes it feel not sensationalized, that it's actually very personal. The focus is not really ever on the abductor or even on the situation that led to them being in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's about that relationship, the mother-son relationship. It's about those two individuals, Ma and Jack, and how this situation has affected them psychologically and relationally. So that's the difference to me, is that it focuses on that. And because there's a more personal focus, I just feel like there's a lot more, it can be nuanced a lot more than if your point is just to say this thing happened and it's horrible. How can we make it right? Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah. So I guess I asked the question because I'm a little bit interested in what people find interesting. So I think you guys have made very clear cases why this movie's worth talking about, why this movie's worth seeing and engaging, and how it does it in a way that is palpable and is accessible to certain age groups. You know, there's definitely people that don't need to see this film, even mm-hmm. though the film explores its topic in a way that is not as bad as it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting to me what lots of films that we're as Christians told not to watch, because like, why would you even endure that? Even if there's a decent conversation, why would you put yourself through watching a film that has these terrible things? And I think the funny thing is movies like this remind me of reading the Old Testament. You know, like you have to come face to face with some pretty tough stuff mm-hmm. in the Old Testament. And I didn't mean to like specifically get all biblical right away, but it's those things that like, this is still life. This is still hard. And I think it's something that hopefully none of us or anyone we know or anyone ever mm-hmm. would ever have to deal with again. But we live in a world where that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So I think it's worth considering the implications, the situations, and the something else that also has shuns at the end.
Well, so, I think this is a very specific situation that does not happen to very many people. But I think the thing that feels very relevant is, well, I mean, there are a bunch of thematic elements in this film that are relevant to a wider audience. And one of them is the redemption of pain, basically, mm-hmm. or healing. And I mean, if you think about where Jack has come from, it's this mystery between pain happening and then something good happening out of that pain. Mm-hmm. And like the question that I really feel like humans we don't have the capacity to answer, which is the good thing worth the pain? Mm-hmm. Are we willing to put up with that to get, you know, so... I mean, I think that Ma doesn't ever show resentment towards Jack for where he came from. Mm-hmm. She seems to me to very clearly value the good that came out of this bad situation. But anyway, I think that that topic is very relevant to a wider audience.
Well, not only that, but it made me also think of this kind of rhetorical question that I wanted to ask to get your reflections on. And Laura, I think you've already started kind of chiseling away at the edges of it. So... Josh, I want you to listen very carefully to my rhetorical question so you can prepare yourself.
Is this like, guess what's in Mikey's head?
Guess what's in Mikey's head. This is like, this guess terrifying. What response I want you to have. But, get it you know, wrong. I did, that would be awesome. It's directed by a guy who makes lots of very introspective movies and existential, and you don't understand them, being Mikey Thistle. But, so what we see in Room... It is the, I think, epitome of the type of scenario that the average person or the average, heck, I wanted to say the average non-Christian would ask. But I think not only would non-Christians ask, I think almost anyone who's of any religion mm-hmm. or non-religion would ask is...
So humans.
Basically humans. Humanity. We'll go with humanity.
Okay.
Human people.
Human people beings. All right. You can't laugh as much about this podcast.
I'm trying to lighten things up.
Okay.
This is very serious.
This is a serious podcast. So this type of scenario is, I think, the epitome of why people ask themselves, where's God? Mm-hmm. Not only that, but like if they believe in God or some type of divine sparklies, like... Why would the divine sparklies let this happen? Mm-hmm. Why would God let good things or bad things happen to good people? Why would God allow this, you know, this child to come into the world like that? But this is not specifically this scenario, but this type of scenario is mm-hmm. exactly something we see in the news every single day.
Mm-hmm. And one of the huge reasons why people turn away from religion.
Exactly. And one of the reasons they turn away, especially from Christianity mm-hmm. and from, you know, just believing that there's an all-powerful, you know, person moving the pieces in the sky anyway. And because people are clamoring for what Jack asks. And he says, I want a better story. Mm-hmm. People are saying, I want a better story than the one where God lets this happen to people. Mm-hmm. So the film, I think, instead... gives us two very different reaction to Brie Larson's mother, or two very different reactions in Brie Larson's mother, who loves and accepts Jack, and then Brie Larson's dad, a strange dad, mm-hmm. who just can't seem to cope with what has happened, mm-hmm. or the origins of Jack. And so we get two people, one who is able to love and accept because she can still see the beauty and innocence in this human being, mm-hmm. for the life that it is. And we see this other person who can only see the pain, mm-hmm. kind of like you're talking about already, Laura. I mean, like this is incredible. This is incredible juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. I remember just thinking like, wow.
Yeah. I can't believe this is on the screen.
Like, yeah.
Like, do people understand what they're saying?
Yeah. Like, and not in like a totally set up or, you know, in kind of trumped up circumstances, just very, very honest. Mm-hmm. So, but I would say this, but both are very honest, you know, very, very understandable.
Yeah.
They're very understandable reactions, you know, because I'm wrestling as a viewer with this as well. But then I kind of have to ask, which reaction actually moves us? Like, which reaction do we identify with? Which one do we think is the more hopeful? Mm-hmm. Which one do we think has a future? And like I said, I want to say that most people came out on the same side of this, but mm-hmm. I asked this in a pseudo rhetorical way to ask you this, Josh. And then why would one kind of stick with us over the other?
Hmm. Well, I think that I mean, from a film standpoint, I mean, I guess they kind of leave it. I don't think they necessarily leave it open as to like which reaction is what the film wants you to think.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you know.
Well, which one did you connect with?
Well, I mean, geez. I mean, as a father, I mean, I guess in my current stage of life, it's easier for me to connect with the child, you know, with Jack, than it is to, as like the father of a grown up daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that maybe it would be more of a juxtaposition for me if I was older and like my nine-year-old daughter was, you know, 17, 18, 19, that kind of age, where it's like, you know, I could really connect with like, oh my gosh, like I can't imagine what it would be like if my 17-year-old daughter was disappeared, you know, was abducted basically, and then reappeared, I think, what, that's 6-7 years later, you know, she's like later. Something like that, and had a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think maybe it would resonate a little bit more like, you know, I would hate the person who did this to her, you know, and the child would sort of be this reminder of what happened to mm-hmm. my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really read that part in the film. Like I resonated with William H. Macy's character in just how difficult that could have been for him to connect with Jack, his, you know, who's supposed to be his grandson.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely resonated a lot more, just personally having a lot of connections to people that have been abused and in different forms, nothing quite like this, but to say that is to, I'm not trying to negate what other people have gone through. So, you know, something that I've learned and also counseled people to do is not to compare their situations to other situations, you know, like mm-hmm. it would be easy for somebody who may have just, you know, been, verbally abused to be like, well, obviously this situation is so much worse. And, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, yes, it probably is, but like, it's your experience, it's your pain. Like, so anyways, that was kind of an aside. Mm-hmm. But I connected a lot more with that situation and just being a father myself, like, and seeing it through the eyes of a child. Like I kept throughout this movie, just because I felt like even the camera and everything was trying to live this story through the eyes of a child, I really connected with like, man, it's hard to be a kid. And it's weird to be a child and to grow up and to not really fully understand what you're going through in life. So I was connecting a lot more with Jack, probably more than any other character, which is also why I was thinking during the movie, is there an age limit on winning Best Actor at the Oscars? So, you know, I was really connecting that, at least, you know, I've on the, on just this, just revisit of the movie, like that's who I was really connecting with. Mm. And I wasn't really connecting with William H. Macy's character. Maybe in 10 years I'll like rewatch this film and be like, yeah, I get it. You know, my daughter would be in 10 years would be 19. So I might connect a little bit more with that, but I'm also kind of more of like, less of a, I'm more of kind of like a connect, you know, priestly kind of guy. Like I connect with people on like an emotional level, and like I try to be a little bit more empathetic. So, it's hard. It was hard for me that this William H. Macy's character was essentially like spurning something that meant so much to his daughter, but mm-hmm. I can understand the battling emotions that is, you know, like you love your daughter, you hate the mm-hmm. abuser. This child is the reminder of it, but he's also your grandson. mm-hmm. Like there's a real wrestle with pain and family and all these, just the movie definitely brings a lot of conflicting, complicated emotions mm-hmm. in the second half, especially I feel in sort of this long meditation on family. And, you know, I knew it instantly, you know, when, you know, I was like, I knew from like the second that I first saw them on screen, I knew that they like, they weren't together anymore. Cause that typically happens.
Yeah.
In when a child dies or a child disappears or whatever, families very often do not stay together. Or I should say a husband and wife very often do not stay together when those things happen. Mm-hmm. If there's like the death of a child or something like that. So anyways.
Yeah, I think it the film does a great job of validating all perspectives mm-hmm. on a situation mm-hmm. like this.
Right. Yeah, they didn't really villainize anyone. Mm-mm. You know, which is weird because I honestly like don't think that they really even villainized the old Nick character. I mean, he was like tertiary to the whole movie. Mm-hmm. He wasn't super villainized. Like he didn't show up and it was like dun dun dun. Yeah. You know, like I mean, he kind of looked a little bit like, you know, just like his face and his glasses. He kind of looked like Walter White with a little bit more hair.
I think one of the hardest things that this movie made me consider is conversations in current culture. And I don't know how long this rant's going to take me.
Oh, no.
but I hope it's not a rant. So when I watch film, I always am interested in seeing how it reflects the views of, is it current culture, like the things that you're hearing most about. And I think in the past year, it's very hard to have not gotten in a discussion with, or avoided a discussion about Planned Parenthood and thus the abortion issue. Hmm. And it's a very tough issue because abortion is a very personal issue. Thing when you were talking about the life of a small child, or if you were trying vehemently to argue that a small life is actually not life. Mm-hmm. And one of the most resounding arguments I get when I try to enter into these discussions are the future quality of life of a child. Mm-hmm. Or what do you do in unfavorable conception cases? Mm-hmm. You know, what happens when, you know, sure, maybe we can give up ground on people using abortion as birth control, but we can't give up ground on, you know, incest or rape and things like this. Mm-hmm. And it's tough because, as Josh pointed out earlier, we're dudes. And lots of people would argue that being men, our voice should not be as loud in this type of conversation. I think that's unfortunate. And I think it's unfortunate for a lot of reasons. One, because men have misused historically their voices so long about women's issues that now they're unwanted.
Mm-hmm.
But moving on from that, like, understanding that rape is a terrible, terrible thing. Unless, of course, you watch a lot of the shows that we feel like we've been watching on HBO or Showtime or Stars, and then apparently everyone gets raped all the time, and it's just part of life.
Thank you, Stars.
Thank you, Stars. but I think, like I said, I think that one of the most frustrating things is people who say if a child will likely not be able to have a great life, then you should be able to end that life because their quality of life.
To protect them
from mm-hmm. the awful life that they're likely to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's the intent of Room or the writer of Room or not, who I don't think I've actually mentioned, who is Emma Donahue. I just want to say Emma Donahue. I know who the writer was. I don't know if that was her intention or not, but in this film, I could not stop thinking about that argument.
Hmm.
Like, who would have more right? Because it's the culmination of both those arguments that are considered very strong arguments. In this particular case, Jack is the result of rape. And in Brie Larson's character's case, she has to think that bringing him into this world is not going to be very satisfying,
mm-hmm.
living in a room, possibly for their entire life.
She's basically allowing him to be born into slavery.
Mm-hmm. And I just think this, the way that this narrative plays out, and it could have easily, and I'll ask a question that our real world's Gene, Ghost Why Her, asked us. Yeah.
How you say that? No, are you
it
sure?
Is, it is not how you say it. I'm just trying to see if Gene's listened to the episode. Has asked us about the fairness of trying to escape in the first place. But this, the way this film plays out, it shows the what Josh pointed out already, the love of a mother and the ability to love someone in an unideal circumstance. And then, even though we do have the very understandable reaction of William H. Macy's character as the dad, who's only reminded of the pain, we also have this beautiful picture of the grandmother, Brie Larson's mom, who can see that, like, none of that was Jack's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack's a beautiful child with a wonderful and innocent way to look at the world. And he would have been, even if he would have always been trapped in Room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to give either of those arguments a lot of credence. It's not easy. I would never say that it's easy. But when I see films like this, I can't stop thinking
mm-hmm.
about how I just cannot be swayed by either of those arguments. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to ending the life of a child.
Yeah, this film definitely shows a positive representation of what it could look like in the darkest of circumstances for that choice to be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to maybe not know how that will, not be able to even conceive how that choice could be good,
mm-hmm.
but then seeing in the future that it actually was the right choice to make, or was a good choice to make. I think there are so many different places I feel like I want to take this. There are so many incredible nuances of this wider theme. But I feel like all those questions are connected to the larger question that the film is posing, which is, what if there is a better story?
Mm-hmm.
What if there is a bigger story? What if there is a world or a power beyond what our eyes can see or mm-hmm. our eyes can perceive? And that is such an incredible, it's an incredible question to pose in the first place. But I feel like this film doesn't just pose it, but actually gives a positive spiritual answer to that question.
Yeah.
Because we actually see it happening. We can sympathize with, I think I sympathize more with Jack than with Brie, because when Brie, or when Ma, leaves Room, she's not really impressed by the real world. It doesn't have the healing power for her than it does for Jack.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we can look at Jack and say, well, he didn't actually know that existed. So he's physically being able to experience a new world, a bigger world than what he had experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Ma is actually being asked to do the same thing, to consider that there is something greater than than her reality.
Mm-hmm.
And when she is freed from Room, she doesn't do a great job, really. I feel like she does not, I would say that her character does not believe that there's something beyond what she can see and what she's experienced. And it leads her to suicide. While Jack's actually thriving in his new reality.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I just feel like...
Attempted suicide.
Yeah. I feel like... Oh, yeah. Did I say committed?
Well, you said leads her to suicide.
Right. Attempted suicide. So I feel like even what you're... Like, all the smaller circumstances of the film, I feel like are connected to that bigger question. Like, even the question of abortion or making that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, it is all related. All of the choices that we make are related to our understanding of wider reality. And if there's something beyond us that has control over the circumstances that we experience. So I think, and it's also connected to what I was saying before about when you experience tragedy or pain, can something redemptive come out of that? Can there be something good? I just feel like especially in the person of Christ, the Christian story actually gives us the most well-rounded response to that question, because here we have Jesus experiencing great suffering and pain that he submits to because of the positive outcome on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And because he submits to that, we have a God who is willing to, we have a God who can validate our mourning and our pain, but also say there's something better. There's something that's coming. This mm-hmm. will be redeemed. And I feel like this film actually presents that in that ideology in a positive way.
Mm. So I really like where you're going with that, Laura, because I think a lot of people do. They start imagining what their world would be like, what they want their world to be like. Oh, I wish there was someone who could understand this pain. Oh, I wish the world was more like this. I wish there was more justice. I wish there was more this or that, you know. And they keep imagining these things. But what we have in the Christian story is something that I would call a world beyond imagination. It's not just something that people have to tell themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a story that sounds good, but is wishful thinking. It's actually better than that. It's beyond that. And it fulfills all those wants and desires.
Mm-hmm. But it requires us to believe in what we can't see.
Exactly.
Right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if, like I said, if you are a Christian, you know, the way you saw the world, then stepping out of that room into the bigger world.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that we still haven't stepped through the final door into full communion, knowing that the world's even bigger than we think, again, beyond our imagination. So I like where you're going with that. What say ye, Josh?
Yeah, well, and I was going to say that, like, it kind of reminds me, like, I think of probably my favorite little narration of Jack's throughout the movie is, like, after they are rescued out of the room, spoiler alert. He, you know, he says, I've been in the world for 37 hours now, you know, and he's like, I've seen pancakes and I've seen stairs and birds and all this other stuff. And, you know, then he's like, and things just are happening. And, you know, it just never stops. And then he says, when I was small, I only knew small things, but now I'm 5. I know everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was trying to guess the end of it. I figured he'd be like, and now I know a bunch more. And then it said, I know everything. I was like, oh man, that's so how a child thinks, you know, like they're very much thinking in superlatives and, like, you know, extremes. But it makes me think of, like, two different things. It makes me first think of just sort of like, as we grow, like the expanding nature of, like, how we experience the world. You know, and this is literally like how this it's a mic. The room is like a microcosm of how like a kid feels in that situation, and just how afterwards, like the world starts to explode in front of them as they age. But then, like, I also think of, like, you know, Paul's words in Corinthians where he's saying, like, you know, when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now, we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face, you know, like we know in part, but we will see fully, even as I've been fully known. And there's sort of like, I almost see this metaphor of like a spiritual awakening in like coming out of room, like only experiencing a little bit of life. But then like when we gain hope and we gain understanding of a bigger, wider picture, that it's like we know everything. Mm-hmm. And like I almost look at that as both like our spiritual awakening, but then like reality beyond. Like it makes me think of like how C.S. Lewis has described like what heaven's like, what it's like to be, what it's like to know and to see God. It's like to know everything and just to see everything happening, like to gain that wider picture. And I don't feel like I can fully articulate this because I'm just kind of like, you guys sort of awakened this idea in me. I liked that narration, but now I'm starting to understand it more. but I just see this like unfolding of like spiritual realities, but also the realities of being a kid too. Again, I'm going back to like, you know, that's why I really think that seeing this through the eyes of the child is both, you know, seeing a little bit of like what it's like. And I can't believe that Abramson captured that so well in so many different ways. And I know that part of it is obviously it's the book and it's the screenplay too. But I feel like it captures like that childlike wonder and imagination. But it also captures the spiritual reality too, of sort of like awakening to like a bigger reality than just like our lone isolated reality in the room. And I know that there's a lot more nuance there, but that's why we're talking about this movie, is because there's a lot of nuance and a lot of different, different things to poke at and look at in this movie. But that's kind of like what you guys are talking about, what I think when I'm thinking about like this greater reality outside of room.
Yeah. Well, I think that hits on probably the thing that most critics have, or especially Christian critics have hit on, that idea that it's obviously a pretty good metaphor for almost a rebirth of sort, almost like a reawakening to a new reality. And I think that comparison's apt. And I think with, once you take the nuances and kind of like what Laura's already said, the things that I've brought up, either about abortion or, you know, asking God why, like these are kind of smaller things to the big reality picture of what does your world actually look like, and what's the scope of that world. So
what can you allow yourself to imagine? I'm feeling like a new perspective on, from this film, really, on when Christ says that really to understand the kingdom of God, you have to become like a child. You have to be able to have that scope of imagination, which actually gets smaller the bigger you get, the older that you get.
Yeah. And I think that repeats itself over and over and over again in this film. And we didn't even really get to a whole bunch of the coping in the second half of this film. Once they actually leave room, like Josh said, spoiler alert. But you know,
doesn't spoiler alert only work if you say it before the spoiler? Beforehand?
Well, if you listen to this podcast, then you should know spoiler, et cetera, et cetera. But so I think there's a lot there, and we could probably talk about this film for a very long time. But I want to kind of make sure we have time to get to all the things. But like I said, again, reminding people that if you can almost take this movie in like 10-minute sections and have something different to talk about in each one under the under the umbrella of what we're already kind of hitting on in this, like I said, this reawakening, rebirth, or re-envisioning of what reality is. Because I think that's a great, not only metaphor, but actual practical thing that's going on in this film. So the closest thing that we have to a listener question for this episode is, again, talking to Gene Gougerer, and him kind of asking us if he said, well, let me just, I'll just read what he said. He said, I was thinking too about motivation and risk, because he said he just recently saw Room and it just blew him away. And that, you know, he wishes he could go back and do his top 10 over again, because Room would totally be right at the top. So he said he was thinking about motivation and risk, and the risk is Brie Larson as Ma sending her son out to free them both. In the way that she did, he said, was extremely high. The risk was extremely high. Yeah. So he asks, kind of like, was it reckless? Was it selfish? Is it even appropriate to ask those questions of her, as the interviewer in the second half of the film does when she has her TV interview?
Mm-hmm.
So I would ask you guys, do you think it was reckless? Do you think it was selfish? Do you think it's something that it's not even appropriate for us to ask because we're not in that situation? You know, like, where do you fall on that? Lots of hmms.
Well, it seemed to me to be more, I never saw it any other way, but it seemed to me that her decision was based more on her, it was more for him than it was for her. But she was sending him out because she had reached a point where she realized, I have to do this for him. I have to be brave and do this for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was because, and I've only seen the film once, regrettably. I wish that I'd had a chance to see it again. But in my memory, she made that choice. I mean, he's 5 years old, so she didn't make that choice for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But she made that choice because Nick was starting to get interested in him.
Mm-hmm.
And before, she would just put him in a cabinet and they would never see each other. She told old Nick, quote unquote, that he wasn't allowed to look at him or, you know,
mm-hmm.
but he started bringing mm-hmm. him toys and started being interested. And so I feel like her level of fear or alarm caused her to make a choice that she had not made before.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. so I agreed with her decision because it's the motivation for that decision seemed to be legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Josh.
Yeah. And I mean, I think kind of the point is that, you know, I think that there's a significant, maybe like with Laura, what you said, fear factor in it, mm-hmm. They don't really necessarily allow us too much into her head as far as that decision goes, but I can imagine that sort of a decision would be an extremely complicated one to make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, the other part of it is like I've significantly talked about, just because the connection that I've made the most with that movie is with Jacob Tremblay's character Jack,
mm-hmm.
but there's this whole other connection aspect of like how Brie Larson's character Ma or Joy is, you know, approaching the second half of this film and how she's dealing with re-entering society and normal life and things like that. And, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine that. I can't remember who it was. I think it was Real Spirituality. One of their reviews talked a little bit about how she was like a mother bear, you know, like a Ma mm-hmm. bear character, and how your protection of your child can vary wildly. There's almost like a feral nature to how you approach your child. And like I said, I can't understand that from a husband standpoint, but I can understand how the decisions that I make about with my children would be complicated and I think would probably be best for them, but also might prove that since I'm a fallen human being, I can make terrible decisions for my children.
Mm.
So this is not even close to being a similar situation as far as like the trauma and all this other stuff. But when our son, who's 7, is actually in the same grade as our oldest, our 9-year-old, because we skipped him ahead of grade, and we have always like feared, did we make the right decision with him? And like, we look forward to like, he's going to graduate high school when he's 16 years old. And like, is that a good decision? Like are we going to regret it when he's 16? Are we going to regret it when he's 20? Are we going to do all this stuff? And it's like, we've made the best decision that we could with the information that we had at the time. And like, we live with that. So it's not necessarily we look at it. And you know what? You know, maybe like 20 years from now, Micah might be like, you know, our son might be like, oh, that was totally unfair and it sucked and this was terrible and this was terrible and this was terrible. But we'll do the best we can not to look back with regret on that because we made the decision at the time thinking it was in his best interest. And it may prove to be in his best interest in the future, even though it might cause him some pain, if that makes sense. You know, like he, you know, he will barely be driving when he graduates. And like, you know, it's just, it's all this complicated mess that it's like, we can't, when you make decisions for your children, because that's the role that you get thrust into when you're a parent, even as terrifying as that might seem, but you know, you make it with the best information you have and you think you're doing what's best. And like Laura, you said, she was doing it because she's being brave for her son. And I don't think it's necessarily an unfair or unjust decision or whatever, you know, that whole situation. But I think that, I guess I didn't really go through it. And maybe it was like empathy I didn't even understand at the time till right now. But I didn't think it was unfair.
Well, I like what you're kind of pointing out too, Josh, because I think if you take that and you also point that to the metaphor that we've been, the larger metaphor we've been hinting at, this idea that a parent is making the best decision for us, even if we don't understand what that decision is,
right.
You know, I think that that also kind of starts to ask like the, why would God let this happen?
Right.
As a new parent myself, I see myself having to do things for my son and being like, he has no idea why I'm doing this to him and why he's so unhappy right now, but he needs me to do this for him.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's a beautiful picture. When I take this and respond specifically to Gene's question about Ma's decision in this movie, I actually never thought it was, I never thought that she thought she was going to get out of there. I didn't think that she was trying to get him to escape, to come back and get her. I mean, there's probably a part of her that was like, well, maybe someone will find him and somehow they'll figure out who I, you know, that I'm out here and then maybe they'll come get me eventually. But it was immediately to get him out of harm's way of being the focus of old Nick. It was the opportunity that she had to free him that was her concern, not her own safety. So was it reckless? A little bit.
Maybe it had risk.
Yeah, I would say, reckless. Yeah, I don't think reckless is probably the right word. I think it was wreckful. you know, it, like they're like,
right, Shakespeare.
They call me Bill Shakespeare. I don't think it was selfish. At least based the way it was presented in the book, it seemed like it was selfless.
Yeah.
To let go of the one thing that she had that she loved.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because she does say at some point that she, or maybe I get Jacob and Jack mixed up. Yeah. Maybe Jack says this, but I remember clearly it being said that she wanted to give up on life. She was miserable, and then Jack came.
Well, because if she wanted to kill herself in a room, she could not do that as long as her son was alive.
Right. So he was giving her meaning, her life meaning, and she was willing to send that away from her for his sake.
Well, I hope that's satisfactory enough for Mr. Gozer.
He's going to quit your team.
He's going to quit our team. He said he had my permission to make a joke out of mispronouncing his name, which means I got to come up with all these other ways to mispronounce his name. But so
it's Gooseware, right?
Goose. Yeah, he was in Top Gun.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll ask this, and it's hard to ask this of a movie that has this much depth to it, even if it's surprising that we didn't think a movie this small would be this powerful. But what were there any critiques that you had, Laura? Were there any, like, you know, as we say, come on moments, or just things that didn't work for you with the film?
There's there really is nothing I can think of that. There was nothing that happened. There were no characters. There was no storytelling that took me out of the film for any moment, for even a moment.
So that's a no?
Yeah, I'm
going to
say no.
I'm going to go with a hard no here. All right. Like I said, which I think in this film is one of those perfectly reasonable things. Josh?
Oh, gosh. I think maybe the only thing I could think of is maybe the only moment that I had, but, you know, you can chalk it up to this just being a part of the story, is, you know, when he was in the back of the truck and kind of like, you know, fumbling around and stuff like that to get out of the rolled up rug or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking, like, don't you think that at like some point he would look back and be like, what is all that noise coming from the back of my truck?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, granted, they played it well. It wasn't like he escaped and like he didn't, old Nick didn't know anything about it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of just like, ah, whatever, you know, like I was being picky in like for 5 seconds. And yeah. Then I was like, ah, never mind. You know, like I'm back into this already. So,
well, with the know, well, I was going to say, with the caveat that I've never actually kidnapped anybody or tried to dispose of a dead body, I assume that if I had a small child that I assumed was dead rolled up in a rug in the back of my truck, I would constantly be glancing back at that thing, making sure that it was exactly like I had left it.
Right, so. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. That was just a little bit of maybe the only point where I felt like there was... where I had to like suspend my disbelief mm-hmm. as far as the, you know, the narrative went. But that's really not saying a whole heck of a lot. So yeah. I'm not really,
well, that's
really, really nitpicking.
That's good. Well, for me, like there was something about this movie that kept it from being like, even though I could easily discuss the film, there's something that still held it back a little bit for me. And I don't know exactly what it was. So I've thought really long and hard. And the best things that I can think of were that, especially in the second half of the film, once they leave room, I think this film wore its themes very heavily on its sleeve.
Hmm.
Almost, you know, where it's almost too direct. We get very few moments that don't explicitly pertain to some theme that they're trying to explore. And I was like, okay, I get it. Now, given... when I was getting it, I was also like getting emotional. So it was like, it was working, which is why it's hard to be nitpicky about it. I think that played a lot, especially as soon as I saw it. The second thing was that though lots of people have really liked Jacob's acting in this film at times, I felt like I was never lukewarm on him. I either was like, wow, that was amazing that they got that from like a 7 or 8 year old. And then other times I was like, gosh, he is such a 7 or 8 year old. Like, how can you get him to do that? And sometimes, so I really, Jack took me out of the films at times, but also Jack completely brought me back into the films at times. So, I mean, I would have never nominated him for an Academy Award, but then again, lots of people get nominated for Academy Awards that don't deserve it. So, so he is kind of my come on moment because, I feel like he was either hot or cold to me. And I would have to watch the movie again to point out some of those cold moments. Cause I know some people are probably not going to agree with that, but that's just kind of how I felt. So, well, but positively, and this is going to, I think, be equally hard for a film that is so rough or so dark at times, with only glimmers of hope here and there, it's kind of hard to have a favorite moment. Because the film doesn't actually, I think, you know, it doesn't tie bow on things. And so we can't be like, oh, the ending was great. So amazing. But were there things that stuck out to you or stuck with you that kind of become your favorite parts, Laura?
I feel like I can't be real specific because it's been a while since I saw the film and I haven't seen it since. So, but I do remember, I remember loving the part where Jack's grandmother's boyfriend. Do we say his name was Doug?
We think his name is Doug.
Okay.
Based on the credits.
Where he really started connecting with Jack, and then when he introduced him to his dog, and when Jack started really transforming, because before he was very like making himself very small. He was always curled up with Ma. He was always speaking in barely a whisper.
Right.
So watching him come alive and watching that happen because somebody was just treating him like a normal kid was pretty powerful. But yeah, I think when I think about this film right now, I'm thinking grand thematic things because I forget a lot of the specific narration or lines, but yeah. But that, I mean, I remember that pretty clearly.
Mm. Josh?
Well, I think, you know, I already mentioned like the kind of narration piece that I thought I appreciated or liked more than any other one.
Yeah.
So there's that. But then the other thing, I was kind of joking before we had started recording that my favorite moment was actually not from the movie. And so my actual favorite moment is from the Oscars when Brie Larson, before she won for Best Actress for this movie, which, you know, I mean, we're recording this after the Oscars. So it's like, you know, we have sort of the background information that Brie Larson has been voted to have had the best performance in a movie, you know, of the year. So, I mean, take that or leave that. But there was a moment after, you know, the Lady Gaga performance of, you know, talking about women who have, or women and men, I think there was men in there too, that, you know, had been abused, sexually abused. And I didn't see this anywhere except that someone shared a GIF, I believe, or something like that on Facebook, or maybe it was a video of just Brie Larson. She was sitting in the front row and she got up and she hugged every single person that was in that performance as they came off the stage. And I thought that was like I thought that was an even more powerful moment, you know, especially since, you know, Brie Larson portrayed a character that was going through those similar things. And it just, it kind of, to me, it struck me as a really great moment of connection between like an actress and people who have really experienced these things. And it just made me appreciate Brie Larson more. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I mean, if she doesn't win the Oscar, the Oscars are null and void and, you know, should just be shut down forever. So, but I kind of think that every year about at least one award. Yeah. So it's just like, we just need to shut down the Oscars. So, cough, Eddie Redmayne. okay. So that was kind of my
favorite. That's great.
So, yeah.
Well, so I would echo the line that you're talking about because I started to see the metaphor kind of blossoming and percolating, and then when Jack has that speech and he's like, now I know everything.
Yeah.
I was like, they've got, like, the writer has to know what they're doing. You know, they have to realize the metaphor here.
Right.
And I was like, I can't wait to talk about this on the podcast at some point, because how can we not mention this line? So I like that because it kind of reinforced like what I thought was where I thought the story was going. And I think the other thing that I really liked is for like metaphorical reasons, for cinematic reasons, for story purposes, I liked when they go back to Room, because especially like when we spend time with Jack and Ma in room seems small, but it doesn't seem cramped.
Yeah.
And when they go back, the way it's shot shows you exactly how small Room had always been. And it's kind of amazing that, like, because we see it through Jack's eyes, Room seems so much bigger when we're in Room the first time. But then when he goes back and he's just scanning it, we're like, oh my gosh, this shed was tiny.
Yeah.
So it, like I said, metaphorically, cinematically, you know, story-wise, there's a lot of great moments when they go back to that shed, or when they go back to the shed, which is Room, and then his kind of being like, "All right, this isn't as great as I remember now. Now that I've seen the world, you know." Again, yeah. Metaphor, like so much cool to talk about. So, I want to give you guys a chance to give a final thought before we kind of head out. So, Laura, is there anything else that you wanted to say that we, or touch on real quick that we didn't hit?
I will try to touch on this really quickly.
Quickly.
But, so this whole film, makes me think of probably my favorite, one of my favorite Christmas songs, which is
Santa Claus is Coming to Town,
which is by Andy Gellhorn. It's called I Will Find a Way.
Oh yeah.
And pretty much the whole, it's a very story, like it's a narrative song, and the whole concept is there's a lover, I guess, singing about the person that he loves trapping themselves in a room too scared to come out because people have abused her and rejected her, and she's too scared to come out of this room. And so he's asking the question, how can I come to the one I love? I will find a way. And then at the end of the song, you realize that the voice is Jesus saying, how can I come to the one I love? And he says, I'll come into the room. I'll be born inside of her. And that just makes me think of this scenario because Ma was helpless, and the one who eventually brings her not only out of the room, but really brings her back to herself once they're free, is somebody who came from with it. Like, he came into the room with her. And, you know, I think that that's not necessarily a story that this film is trying to tell, but it's something that from my spiritual background or story or narrative, I can't help but see, and that really moves me to think about Christ coming into my room, quote unquote, to make meaning of my life, to broaden my story. So I mm-hmm. guess that's
good
final thought.
Oh yeah, that was short enough.
Yeah, it doesn't have you moving from topic to topic.
No.
All right, Josh, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I hate always following things that end up being so profound. So thanks, Laura, for making this seem highly not profound in comparison. The thing that struck me more than anything, and I keep mentioning this, is just how much I think they did such a good job of connecting with and telling the story through the eyes of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as this story, you know, and like we said, that Brie Larson won Best Actress and very much displays a wide-ranging emotions, and it can be about her as well. I think that ultimately this story is seen and told through children's eye, or through the eyes of a child. And like, the thing that I kept thinking throughout the movie that kept getting me emotional is all of the moments where it's like the child making realizations, Jack making realizations, like narrating and telling these different, like how he sees reality. And in what I do for my job, part-time of what I do besides being an associate pastor is like, I am also kind of like the children and family pastor
mm-hmm.
at our church. And so I deal with kids a lot, and I love kids. I have four of them. I better love kids because they're always around all the time. And you know, I think that something that I think is a major part of this movie is that, being a kid, as much as being an adult is difficult, being a child is hard.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you think about when you grow up, like the unfolding reality of life and just how your childlike reality is very much like room, and it's very contained. It's as much as you want to teach your kids as they grow up that the world's not all about them, it's very much all about them when they're small. And so, like, if anything, I can say, like, try. I think we can all do a better job as adults, because I think there are hardly any, I don't think any children listen to this podcast. But if you are listening, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
We're a clean podcast. We don't swear. So you can listen. I think that if you can try to understand and empathize with how a child understands both the world and like their life, that it can help you to understand your kids or other people's kids a lot better. And then kids won't grow up necessarily as much thinking adults are a bunch of boring, mean people. So, you know, like, it can be really hard, because when yeah. you're an adult, you have such a bigger understanding of the world, and mm-hmm. kids just don't have that. Yeah. And so it's like, why are you like that? You know, like, I feel like I think about that about my kids all the time. Like, why do you think like this? And it's like, this movie gives a little bit of a reminder, like, oh yeah, like kids are learning to understand the world around them.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah, not just what to think, but how to think.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, like, make that connection with the kid. It's hard, okay? Like, I'm not up on a soapbox. I'm down with you trying to understand children. So
it sounds like, Josh, family and whatever pastor of whatever gospel.
All right, let's not bring back this episode, all right?
Let's resurrect that. That was great.
I think that's good. And, you know, obviously fits what we've already been talking about. And speaking of what we've already been talking about, I would end with this, the idea that this film is tough. This film has lots of dark possibilities, and some people, I mean, it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Not as dark as it could be, like we've pointed out, but it's still rough. It's still a lot of
mature themes.
Yeah, mature themes. But if someone asked me if they should see this film, I would say that Room is the story of a parent who is willing to bring life into an imperfect world under imperfect circumstances and protects that life at great cost to her through imprisonment and physical abuse, ultimately making way for that child to be introduced to a new world that is incredibly more vibrant, real, and true than any other the child could have ever dreamed before. And that, to me, is powerful.
Mm.
So that in and of itself, I think, is enough reason to recommend this film. So I hope you get a chance to see it. I hope you've already seen it, if you've listened this much, because as we did point out, we spoilered after we spoilered. So our bad. But
it would still be worth seeing even if you knew that they got out of the room.
Yeah, because I think if you watch the preview, like, they basically have scenes where they're out of the room anyway. So it's not really not necessarily the point of the film. But with that said, I thought this was a great conversation that still only, like oftentimes, kind of, you know, is just starting to chip away at the iceberg
mm-hmm.
of conversation that can be had about this movie. So if there's something we didn't talk about, feel free to keep the conversation going. Feel free to keep the conversation going with our two guests or anyone else at Real World Theology. And to do that, Laura, I would invite you to let people know how they can get a hold of you or follow what you do.
I'm on Twitter at Laura_Fissel, and I write reviews for realworldtheology.com.
That's a great website. I suggest everyone go there. Josh, where do you write at? How can people get a hold of you, Josh?
They can get a hold of me. You can go to the Real World Theology website, and you can click on my contact information. You can read regular weekly columns or articles from me, as well as reviews and stuff like that. So you can also find me on Twitter at Hey, It's That Josh. Twitter confounds me, but I will use it if people directly interact with me. I really enjoy being on Letterboxd, which is the Facebook for movie lovers, as official spokesman. You can go there and find me. And I love reading about what you guys have to say about movies on Letterboxd, and I appreciate it when you like what I have to say about movies on Letterboxd. So always catch up, and then you can see what movies I'm watching right now.
Josh, that's very funny.
What?
I don't know. I wanted to awkwardly laugh at your joke.
Oh, great. So that's where you can find me. I'm all over the internet, and you can also find me on Real World Theology. Perhaps you've heard of it.
I have. It's pretty great.
It is really great.
Well, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter, and I also do lots of things at realworldtheology.com, which I suggest you go to. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed this conversation, join our Facebook discussion group for Real World Theology, where you can interact with all the people that are involved with Real World or have been guests or anything like that. It's a great place to have discussion. So, as usual, we're thankful for our excellent guests who've allowed this conversation to take place. Please follow them on social media and around the web. Meanwhile, we're very thankful for you, the listener, for taking time to make this a part of your week. So until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
But, okay, so the value here, or the reason why this film, to me, doesn't feel exploitative? What's that word?
Explosive?
No. We can go with that, though.
Yeah, you would think, but you'd be wrong.
I would think. Why am I wrong?
That could be a thought that you would have, but it would be stupid.
But it would be the dumb.
Wow, that's not what I said.
That's what I heard, Josh.
It would be the dumb thought. The kind of thought an idiot would have.